You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both longtime MMA journalists, and for the last 11 years, we've been meeting here every week to break down all the action in the wild, weird, and occasionally wonderful world of mixed martial arts. Ben, we're a day late here, which is not ideal for UFC 292 week, but nonetheless, it's a Tuesday episode of The Proper, which at least there will be no Tuesday news curse. Am I right?
Yeah. Save that shit for Wednesday, my guys.
We could be dealing with a Wednesday news curse this week. We are pleased to be joining you despite some difficulties yesterday. We're going to spend this episode, for the most part, looking forward to UFC 292, which goes down at TD Gardens in Boston, Massachusetts on Saturday. Of course, you got your bantamweight men's title on the line. Aljamain Sterling defending against Sean O'Malley. Also a women's strawweight title fight where Zhang Weili and Amanda Lemos are going to do the damn thing. You got Ian Garry on the card against Neil Magny. Damon Blackshear, who just won last weekend, has filled in on this card against Mario Bautista. And then you got Chito Vera against Pedro Munhoz. That's the main card. Chris Weidman returns against Brad Tavares on the undercard and some other stuff. Gerald Meerschaert down there as well. So we're going to spend much of this episode breaking that down. We'll also later on talk a little bit about Vicente Luque's win over Rafael Dos Anjos from last Saturday at a fight night down there at the Apex. But we expect to be mostly interested in UFC 292. So we're going to get to it. Ben, you got anything to add? You got anything you want to put in there? You want to tell the kids what was going on at your house yesterday that made it so that we couldn't record?
Yeah, well, so I'm having a new sprinkler system installed at my house, and I tell you what, they came over here with a team, just a team of guys, to put this thing in. It was fast and furious. It was less than one afternoon's of work, and they were done with it. They disappeared just off into the wind somehow. I don't even know if the shit works, because it's just, there was a blitzkrieg of activity over here. But part of that included using some sort of equipment that at times literally shook the entire house. And I record this show in my basement office, and I thought, well, maybe it'll be better down there in the basement. Oh, no. No, it was much worse. Much worse down here. Came down here, and just like the walls are rattling. And I was like, maybe this is not the ideal recording environment for a podcast that's just two dudes talking, you know?
It's been a tough summer for the waterworks over there at Casa de Folks. A lot of problems with the H2O this summer.
You know, this is not so much a problem as just the sprinkler system was a million years old and needed to be updated at some point. So, and also, as I learned, you move into a house, you got a little sprinkler system, everything set up to cover the entire yard. If you go and get some highfalutin ideas like, hey, why don't I put a 6-foot privacy fence in here so that I can kind of wall off my backyard into its own little paradise, that's all well and good. But the sprinkler system was not designed for that. The wall now interrupts the flow of that H2O as it's supposed to spread out across the lawn. So it's time for some updates. You know what I want to do? I'm thinking I might become one of those front yard garden guys. You know how people parcel off just a little corner of their front yard, put a little garden there. Why couldn't I be one of those guys? Chad, I could be one of those guys.
See, I see you more as a guy standing out in his front yard with the nozzle on the hose, hand spraying down the grass and glaring at kids when they drive by on their bike. That's more how I see you. Not necessarily sort of like a back to the earth, hippy dippy guy growing your kale and your scallions out there in the garden.
Oh no, we're talking purely decorative garden that I have.
Okay, just like flowers and shit.
Flowers and shit. Nothing that's of any use to anybody other than beautifying the world, much like myself. You know, that's how I see. That's how I go about my business, as you can tell. So. Why not have a front yard garden that reflects that? Because it's either that or I go topiaries, you know, just a lot of hedges in elaborate shapes that I am constantly chipping away at with clippers. So well, there are options.
I mean, I think that that's great. People often ask me, what do you think Ben Folks' future is? And I say horticulturist.
Yeah.
Topiaries. Future horticulturist is what I say. So I'm glad that you're getting into that. Remember, you're listening to the Co-Main Event podcast proper. This show drops every Monday afternoon for free in your timelines and your podcast libraries. But this is not all, friends. You can find the Co-Main Event, Ben Folks, and myself all week over on Patreon. Hit us up at patreon.com/co-main-event. And get loads of extra audio and video content, as well as access to our official Discord message board. The coolest people in MMA are constantly chatting it up over there on any number of topics, really, MMA and non-MMA related. And over there on the message board, the only rule is no a-holes. Sound good? Sound good, but you're not totally sold? Wondering what the Patreon is really all about? Well, good news. Right now, you can sign up for a 7-day free trial. At the $5 level, it's a great chance to check out a week's worth of the content over there and decide if you want to take the plunge and sign up, or if you want to peace out the game like Derek Lewis, only to change your mind and come crawling back a few months later. But look, you guys, we can only keep making the show with the support of awesome listeners like you. So come party with us. We think it's the funnest, smartest, most welcoming group of men and women talking fights online. Head over to patreon.com/co-main-event and sign up to join the team. You could also support the show by scooping up some dope CME merchandise. Just head over to our merch shop, where you'll find old favorites like the original Dundasso t-shirt, the old school Cowboy Astronaut Cigarettes t-shirt, and you can also find some cool new stuff like Are You Fucking Kidding Me shirts, shirts for the dreaded and powerful MMA gods, the hottest seller on the market, the Bobby Knuck shirt, and of course, the newest release, Volcamania. Volcamania is running wild over there at the Co-Main Event shop. Just go to comainevent.com and click the link at the top of the page that says Shop. We're partnering with our friends at Superconductor on the shop. They come up with the designs. They are a brand and design studio from Portland, Oregon. You can hit them up. We can't recommend them highly enough. Check them out at studiosuperconductor.com or on the grams at Studio Superconductor. We got music this week from longtime listener and friend of the show, Ross Jarborg. If you like what you hear from him on this episode, you can check out more at soundcloud.com/STHLM Ross. That's R-A-S. I believe it stands for Stockholm Ross. STHLMRAS. Check them out over there. Three rounds, as usual, this week in the Co-Main Event podcast. In round number one, if you're Aljamain Sterling and you're fighting Sean O'Malley on Saturday at UFC 292, you pretty much have to have your whole corner walk out wearing Michael Jackson Thriller jackets, right?
That's a given.
And And in round number two, Amanda Lemos seems like a bit of a weird choice to fight Zhang Weili for the women's strawweight title. But then again, it's a whole weird world of weird choices in MMA right now. And in round number three, Vicente Luque is a walking miracle cured by God in order to return to the octagon and have kind of a so-so fight with Rafael Dos Anjos. All that plus Are You Fucking Kidding Me and Just Saying Stuff. But first, like we always do about this time, let's do a little bit of listener mail.
Listener mail.
This week's listener mail is once again brought to you by NordVPN. Kids, have you signed up to get a free bonus month from NordVPN? When you go to nordvpn.com/comain or use the code comain, that's all one word. If you haven't signed up, you really, really should. With NordVPN, you get the fastest VPN on the planet. NordVPN provides online protection with a single click. Don't miss your favorite content, even when you're traveling. Stay at home virtually. Stay safe from malware with threat protection. Ben and I both have it. We use it on all of our devices. Ben, I know you love NordVPN. What's your favorite part of using it?
Well, you know, Chad, I love the way it kicks on no matter where you are to keep you protected, especially as you're bouncing from public Wi-Fi to public Wi-Fi. Doesn't matter where you are. Doesn't matter if you're down at the mall buying yourself one of those Michael Jackson Thriller jackets like Mirab Davishvili. Doesn't matter if you're then down at your local haberdasher picking yourself up a cool Kangol, also like Mirab Davishvili. Doesn't matter if you're at, say, an arena supporting a friend and have to jump up in the crowd to go after a wisecracking fan. Again, like Mirab Davishvili, NordVPN has got you covered. You can also access Nord's amazing cybersecurity apps, including the NordPass Password Manager, helping you keep all your passwords straight and close at hand. And with the NordLocker encrypted cloud storage app, you can keep your files backed up, synced, and protected from snoopers, loss, or malware in its secure cloud. Nobody will see, touch, or sell them.
Sign up right now for any of NordVPN's handy two-year plans and get an additional month for free by going to nordvpn.com/comain or use the code comain. That includes all the plans, the standard plan, the plus plan, and the complete plan. It's risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Get your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/comain or use the code comain. First piece of listener mail this week comes to us from Jay Gargiulo, who writes the podcast frequently. He's over on Patreon. He says, after hearing that the judges came to a unanimous decision on Saturday night, Cub Swanson was preemptively applauding his opponent, only to hear his name called. During the post-fight interview, he was gracious enough to concede that Hakeem Dawodu probably should have gotten the their fight. Could the presence of his tiny, bespectacled children cage side have swayed the judges? Do we even deserve this man in this godforsaken sport? Cub Swanson was a pretty significant underdog out there this weekend and went and pulled off an unlikely decision win over Hakeem Dawodu, which was frankly great to see if you are a fan of the old school guys in this sport. Cub Swanson, 39 years old, going to turn 40 in November. And he was coming in here off a loss against Jonathan Martinez. Now, though, Ben, he's won 4 of his last 6. He's 4-2 with the losses to Martinez and then one to Giga Chikadze back in May of last year. So I don't know. Perhaps we're out here making Cub Swanson an underdog and overestimating his demise a little too soon.
I do like the suggestion that his tiny, bespectacled children might have swayed the judges, because they are fucking adorable. All of them with their little glasses on, Chad. Come on.
Yeah.
You're going to sit there and tell them, sorry, your dad lost this one. I don't want to be the person to do that. I don't blame the judges if they don't either. I also think, though, I mean, for one thing, I appreciate Cub Swanson's honesty in the moment, that he was not going to hide the fact that he did not think in the immediate aftermath that he won that fight. He's standing there shaking his head, already starting to applaud Hakeem for the victory that he did not get, and then was pretty frank in the post-fight interview about it. I do think, though, that one thing that's worth noticing is Hakeem Dawodu, he gets in a lot of these kind of fights that are close and that could kind of go either way. And I think that to some extent, that's a stylistic issue. And like, if you even look, you know, you go down his record where he lost this decision to Cub Swanson that you could argue he'd won. He lost the decision to Julian Arosa. And then before that, won a unanimous decision, lost a unanimous decision, and then won two split decisions in a row. Like, he has, just like in his last like seven or eight fights, like three different split decision victories, which tells you, like, that's a guy who's ended up in a lot of close fights, and stylistically a lot that where you're not making it super clear for the judges, perhaps. You know, we all know that MMA judges are liable to do damn near anything. And we've seen this before with some fighters where it's like, if you are counting on a style that wins rounds by very slim margins, you're always going to be playing with fire. Yeah. It's only a matter of time before that goes against you. We saw Benson Henderson do it for a long time. Lyoto Machida did that at some points in his career, where it's like, if you are counting on these judges to be so finely attuned to every aspect of the game that they notice these small margins that you're winning, and you could be winning every round by small margins, eventually it's going to go the other way, and you're going to be pissed off about it.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, your advice is make it more obvious that you won.
Yes. Make it more obvious that you won. Show up with some bespectacled children.
Yeah.
You know?
Cute-ass bespectacled children might help you
All things being equal, the guy with cute bespectacled children might take it.
I've heard guys with cute bespectacled children there on Fight Night are undefeated this year. So that's something we could keep in mind. Next question this week comes to us from Darkwing Duck, another frequent emailer of the podcast, who writes, "This news from John Nash on Bloody Elbow about the class action lawsuit is kind of mind-blowing. Could you guys explain it to me? Is this stuff that might actually happen? # mind blown." Of course, he is referring to events in Nevada court last week where Judge Richard Boulware II, or as Ben Folks and I like to call him, Junior.
Richie Junior.
Certified the class action status of this longstanding antitrust lawsuit that several former fighters filed years ago now against the UFC. And frankly, in the explanation of why he chose to grant class action status to this lawsuit, Judge Boulware pretty much eviscerated a lot of the UFC's former and current business practices, some things about the contracts, some things about how they have gone about eliminating the competition and for what reason they have gone about eliminating the competition, how they have used their power in the industry to control fighters, to control cash flow, to control other things like that. Basically going down a list and ticking off frequent criticisms of the UFC inside the MMA bubble and saying, yes, all of these are true and correct. So at this point, it doesn't look great. It doesn't look great for the UFC in how this class action lawsuit might proceed. Of course, it also could take another long period of time, considering how slow the rest of this thing has progressed. And there is a chance to settle. There is a chance to appeal. It is unknown at this time what will turn out to be the end result of this lawsuit. But if it did go through, yeah, it could totally change the landscape of this sport. Some ways for the better for competition with the UFC, some ways for the better for fighters. And like we talked about on Friday, we basically dedicated an entire episode of Friday's Power Hour behind the Patreon wall, if you guys want to go check that out, to this topic. Some of the ways that it could change the sport would pretty obviously be good for fans. And so this is the kind of thing we ought to be paying attention to, even if on the surface it seems a little dry, perhaps boring, perhaps impenetrable. But this could turn out to be the biggest news story of the last 20 years in this sport, frankly.
Yeah. If this continued in this fashion, on this trajectory that we've seen, it does have the ability to completely reshape the sport. So it's huge. The thing is that, like you said, for one thing, it's already grinded very slowly. Just the point from saying, all right, I'm ready to rule on the class status to actually issuing the ruling was years. So who knows how long it could be until you actually get some finality to this thing. And also, if you're the UFC right now, you kind of have a couple different options. You know, of course, there's the appeal process to begin with, but also just trying to draw it out as long as you can, especially now that the UFC has a different owner than it did for most of the time that this class action suit covers. And as you have thrown out there as a possibility, you keep saying stuff along the lines of, isn't it just a matter of time until Saudi Arabia or some oil-rich company owns this thing that Endeavor thinks, okay, we got all the money we can get out of this thing, now let's unload it. Now, yeah. Having this thing hang over you might affect the purchase price now, but it also seems like the UFC could just take the route of, let's just try to delay it as long as possible before we ever have to deal with it, and it seems like they'll probably be able to do that for a good long time. The other option, like you said, is trying to settle. Now, that's where it gets really tricky, I think, especially because it's like, if you're the fighters bringing this suit, you might tell yourselves, hey, we brought this because we want to make a change in this sport. But the initial group that brought this, they're all kind of past their fighting days for the most part. They're fighting primes, at least. And so if the UFC comes and offers an opportunity for everybody to get a payment out of this, even if you had loftier goals, you know, who knows? Who knows how that shakes out? It does seem like after the certification of the Classic, that was a big obstacle that, you know, I'm not a legal expert, but from reading about these kind of things, it seems like anybody trying to bring one of these suits, the biggest hurdle to get over is getting the class certification. They got that. And the UFC is looking at, what, around 1,200 fighters sort of automatically enrolled in the class action lawsuit, which, by the way, as a public service announcement, I saw my guy Eric McGrocken mention this on Twitter, but fighters out there, don't believe anybody who tells you that you need help to be enrolled, like you need them to be your legal representative. You're automatically enrolled if you're in that class period, unless you opt out. That's a lot of people that you could be having to answer to in this class action lawsuit. So you don't know exactly how that part of it is going to play out, but it does seem like this is where, if you're the UFC, you can't deny that this shit has gotten real. Yeah. You know, when they certify the class, that's when you got to be, okay, what are we doing here? What's our long-term strategy? Are we looking to settle? Are we looking to just delay as long as possible? Do we still think we're going to win it in the end? Because you're right, the way the judge laid out a lot of these points is very much like agreeing with everything that the plaintiffs have brought up, pretty much.
Yeah. We talked about this on Friday. I said it then. I will just go ahead and reiterate it for a wider audience. At this point, I don't even think you can argue against the idea that John Nash is one of, if not the most consequential MMA reporter of the last decade or so, because he has been out in front of this story from the beginning. He has been out in front of reporting on all of the UFC's finances over the last decade or so. And frankly, we wouldn't know anything about those topics if not for the work of John Nash. So I just want to give him a big shout out for doing all this stuff. As I said before, those two stories are probably the most important stories in MMA of the last 20 years. And John Nash has almost single-handedly explored all of them. And his reportage informs the fans. It informs the other coverage that other MMA websites do. So you got to congratulate and applaud John Nash for his work on that. And I would say, doing it as a part-timer, if I'm not mistaken. John works in an industry completely unrelated to MMA, has a full-time job, does other shit. And for him to do this kind of work for this sport as a part-time guy is kind of unbelievable. He doesn't do it for the money. He doesn't do it for the attention. He doesn't do it for the clicks or whatever nonsense the fucking anti-media trolls will spew on social media. He does it because he cares about it and because he's good at it. And I think we owe him a real debt in this sport for keeping track of this shit, because nobody else is doing it as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and that is one thing that I brought up on the Friday Power Hours. If you're reading any sort of coverage, and a lot of the coverage from the other MMA sites, especially when this big news just broke last week, was perfunctory at best. Like, we just got to have something on it, so we're going to put something up there. Anything any of the other MMA media members know or have to tell you about this thing is informed largely by reading John Nash's coverage. So we got to give a shout out to him.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Next question this week comes to us from Trevor Finch, who writes, Dana going to do Dana shit Regarding the coach's challenge on Tough, Dana was quote-unquote furious. Read the quote below. Funny, I watched the show and he didn't look furious at the time. Here's his quote. Are you fucking kidding me? This thing was filmed. Oh, wait. No, this is not his quote. Man, some of these things are just hard to read. Are you fucking kidding me? This thing was filmed months ago. He was there the whole time. If he was concerned, he could have stopped it then. Typical Dana having opinion after he is called out, blaming the promotion. Here's his quote. This is Dana White's quote. I'm going to tell you this. It was a huge fucking clusterfuck by the production team that shot this thing. Completely fucking irresponsible, completely a shit show, and both of them could have been hurt doing this. It was fucking ridiculous what happened during the coaches challenge. Dangerous, stupid, irresponsible, and just completely fucking ridiculous on the part of the production crew that handled the coaches challenge. I was literally fucking pissed off. Disgusting. Won't happen again. Now, I wouldn't waste one moment of the precious years I have left on this earth watching The Ultimate Fighter at this point. But I believe this was a sit in an ice bath as long as you can competition. I could be wrong about that.
They were sitting in an ice bath and answering like trivia questions.
Okay, but so
they were sitting in an ice bath for like half an hour.
Was it the trivia part that Dana was mad about? They could have pulled their brains.
He found that disgusting.
Yeah.
I got a point. I was literally fucking pissed off.
Yeah, no, that's not what that word means.
What? The only way to use the phrase pissed off is like to say angry. There's not like a literally and a figuratively of that. There's just, he needs to remove literally from his vocabulary, because most of the time he's just completely incorrectly using it. Other times, Chad, the shit is superfluous.
Yeah.
You don't need to literally. What he wants is very. The word he wants there is not literally, it's very. I was very fucking pissed off. That's what you're trying to say. He's using literally as just like to show the extremes of his emotions, which generally tend toward the pissed off variety about most things.
He doesn't seem to have a lot of other emotions, frankly. I'm surprised they're still doing the coach's challenge. I remember the coach's challenge as like a Randy Couture, Chuck Liddell era invention. I remember bowling and ping pong with, you know, Uriah Faber and some other people long ago.
They ran out of good ideas years ago. That's how they ended up here.
I guess you got to pad the programming a little bit. You got to be able to fill time with something, and maybe it's the coach's challenge that enables you to do that. Hey, man, frankly, I got to be honest. If I was sitting in a production meeting and they were like, we're going to have Michael Chandler and Conor McGregor sit in ice baths and answer trivia questions, I would have been on board. I would have been like, that sounds like a good coach's challenge, because sitting in ice baths is something that fighters do anyway. So there's a tie-in with the sport, and then answering trivia questions, hell yeah, sounds like a good idea. Now, is it the production team's fault that it becomes dangerous, or is it that Conor McGregor and Michael Chandler are too tough for their own goddamn good and sit there in the ice bath for a half an hour or whatever?
Well, maybe part of the problem is you have people who have seen other people sit in ice baths, and so they're like, okay, let's do that, and they maybe haven't sat in one themselves, and so they think they don't have a good concept of what a normal amount of time to be in the ice bath is. Also, you know, you could do an ice bath. There's a way to do it where it depends on, you know, you could make it cold and unpleasant, but without making it physically dangerous to anybody for extended periods of time. All that kind of stuff. I mean, I get the idea of the coach's challenge is that part of the way we're trying to get viewers on this show is with the names of the coaches involved. It's hard to sell you on they're going to fight at the end because A, maybe they won't, especially in this instance. And B, if they do, you don't need to watch 1 second of the goddamn show in order to enjoy it, because you already know who they are. They wouldn't be coaches in the first place, and they're not going to do the fighting on the show. They're going to talk to each other maybe nose to nose in a heated fashion occasionally, and that's about it. So you want to have them directly involved in some way, but frankly, the coaches challenge concept peaked when we had Big Nog and Frank Mir in a soccer shootout.
I remember that. Yeah,
that was it. We should have shut it down at that point. There's nothing left to do. There's no new ground left to cover there.
I can't wait for the MMA media headline that reads Conor McGregor breaks silence about losing hands and feet in tragic ice bath mishap. I'm waiting for that one. Next question this week comes to us from user 10534.
Okay.
So there you go. He writes, TJ Dillashaw, horror comic comeback. That's the subject line. This was pretty notable from the MMA Junkie story, without comment, except he may need a new nickname. This is a quote from the story about TJ Dillashaw. But I have to have super extensive shoulder surgery, Dillashaw says. What I'm waiting on right now is some cadaver parts. I need a cadaver shoulder head bone because mine got all dented. Yeah, it's. I don't think it's that unusual to use cadaver parts in these types of surgery. They used to do it for knees. Yeah, for like an ACL. You could go get a dead guy's ACL, and I would be like, has Usain Bolt died? Could I get his ACL? Actually, no. I want the pristine ACL of like a New York stockbroker who never did a thing. Just his ACL is perfect. Never been used. I don't know if they're still doing that. I guess, is that still the technology, or are we growing new ACLs in a fucking petri dish now and sewing them onto people? I'm not sure.
I believe that we're still getting those things off of cadavers. I have not heard about, though, the head getting that, like a bone and putting that part in there. Also, his description, mine got all dented.
Yeah, see, that to me is the most surprising part of this quote.
That don't sound great.
Yeah. I can't wait for TJ Dillashaw to return with his dead guy shoulder head bone and reclaim the men's bantamweight title. That'll be amazing.
TJ seems like he's having a harder time than many do with his retirement. And I get that it has different circumstances, that at least for him, he's telling himself, I'm still the best bantamweight in the world, except for this bum ass shoulder. Like, if it weren't for that, I'd be sitting there with the strap around my waist right now. And, you know, we've met MMA fighters. They'll cling at times to very flimsy excuses. This one actually has some basis for it, because at least when you see him in these fights, like you saw him in that Aljamain Sterling fight, the shoulder was a big fucking problem.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying he would have won the fight without it, but it definitely cost him the fight. And so if you feel like, in other aspects, I could still do it. I'm still really good at this, except for this one problem I have. If only I could get it fixed, then maybe I'd still be on top of the mountain. It's like, even if that were true, more time is going out the window all this time that you're sitting around waiting for your cadaver head bone or whatever. Like, it doesn't seem like a situation that's going to make it easy for him to accept retirement.
Yeah. I feel like anytime anyone talks about how they would still be men's bantamweight champion if not for injuries, whatever glass Dominic Cruz is holding just explodes in his hand. He just shatters it immediately as soon as he hears anybody else talking about that. That's going to do it for listener mail this week. If you have a question, comment, or concern that you would like to air to the podcast in future weeks, you know how to do it. Just go to the website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. Right now, we are going to go ahead and get started with round number one. Well, Ben, this could be the culmination of the UFC's long Sean O'Malley experiment, I guess is what you would call it. It had seemed from the moment that he appeared on the Dana White Contender Series that the UFC in some ways had Sean O'Malley pegged as a superstar. And it seems like they were not mistaken in that claim, because when we were down in Las Vegas last year for the Co-Main Event Podcast Patreon meetup, meeting a bunch of the patrons, hanging out, drinking beers, slapping backs, having a great time, we went out to one of these live watch parties out there in Vegas at a bar that I keep wanting to call Blondie's, but it might have been called Lucky's. I don't know. Could have been either one. Okay, yeah. Blondie's. And there's a lot of people there to watch the UFC. And Sean O'Malley, this was the one where Sean O'Malley fought Peter Yan. And when Sean O'Malley appeared for his walkout, he got, frankly, one of the biggest ovations of the night from the people in attendance at that watch party. And he otherwise does seem to enjoy a lot of popularity in the UFC. Now, Sean O'Malley is from Montana. He grew up down the road from us in Helena. He should be one of our guys. We should be on this podcast 100% in the bag for Sean O'Malley. And yet somehow he's not really. He's not really one of our guys. And in fact, he perhaps appeals to a generation younger than us, I guess, because I don't totally get why he is one of the bigger stars in the UFC at this point. He seems fine to me in terms of the public image and what you get outside of the cage. I don't totally know where the overwhelming popularity comes from, but here we are, Saturday night, TD Garden, men's bantamweight title, on the line, Aljamain Sterling. Is Sean O'Malley good enough to cash in now on this hype and these expectations that the UFC seemed to have for him from the beginning of his run?
Well, first of all, I must correct you on a fact. When we watched Sean O'Malley at UFC 276, that was not the Peter Yan fight. That was the Pedro Munhoz one.
Oh, right.
It ended in the second round due to the accidental eye poke, and then Sean O'Malley acted like, yeah, but I basically won, right? Then they matched him up against Peter Yan the following October, and you'll remember what we said about that was, we felt like, did the UFC just say, ah, fuck it, with its slow Sean O'Malley build and say, right, forget it, throw this guy to the wolves. We're tired of waiting to see what he can develop into. And we all thought, Peter Yan going to murder this dude. And that's not the way it went. It's a close fight. Sean O'Malley wins a split decision in that one. A lot of people maybe thought deserved to go the other way, but it's closer than anybody really expected. People thought Peter Yan is levels above Sean O'Malley. And so he surprised some people there and then gets a title shot off the basis of that and off the basis of the popularity. Because you're right. Like, I was at the one the previous July, the one where he fought on the undercard of that Conor McGregor one where he broke his leg. He fought late replacement Chris Martino. And the crowd pop for Sean O'Malley when he walked out was the biggest one that we had seen and the biggest one of the night until the main event with Dustin Poirier and Conor McGregor. And seeing it live, seeing especially, you know, the live UFC audience is a different audience than the sort of general online UFC audience. But those people really were into Sean O'Malley and his whole shit. So I think that there is a real fan connection there for him that is working and that the UFC recognizes. And as far as like what it is, I mean, maybe one of the reasons that a couple middle-aged dudes like us don't get on totally on the Sean O'Malley bandwagon is because, you know, he's from Helena, but then moved to Arizona, and you don't hear him talk too much about Montana. He's not, like, really dying to make that association for people all that much. But for the, you know, younger crowd that really grew up thinking maybe professional video game player on the internet is a viable career path, they look at Sean O'Malley and you're like, okay, this guy is sort of living a life that I recognize and understand and maybe even aspire to. And so, like, that's why he perhaps speaks to that segment of the fan base. And, he's a fun guy to have around in the sport. Like, he's a good interview, interesting guy, has a fun fighting style, all that stuff. Now, can he cash in against a guy like Aljo, who is fucking good? To me, the biggest variable here, the one that's going to really determine everything, is Aljo at 100% physically, mentally, and really all in and ready to be here for this fight? Because you'll recall, it wasn't that long ago he was out here talking about how his shins were mushy, that his body was really beat up, and you can really understand why. Like, the pressure on Aljo to really quickly turn around and defend this title again is very different from the non-pressure the UFC will put on champions that it actually likes. Yeah. You know, like, he comes out here, you know, if I had that TJ Dillashaw fight last October, also happens to be the same month that in the same fight card even that Sean O'Malley fought on, I believe. And then in May defends the title, a 5-rounder against Henry Cejudo. And then we want him to turn right around in August, do another 5-rounder. And if he says anything about that maybe that's too soon, then he's an asshole. He's treated like just an absolute, like, spoiled brat champion. Can you believe this guy? And it's like, man, to prepare for these five rounders, that's tough. He had to prepare for a five rounder, you know, like in all these fights because he's been fighting for the belt one way or another for basically the last 2 years. But then to go in there and actually go five hard rounds with Henry Cejudo, a former two-division champion, and then you want to be able to turn right around and be like, okay, so, you know, we'll see you in 3 months' time. Like, that's a lot, man. And so he seemed like he kind of got pressured into this one, kind of got pushed into it a little bit before he was ready. And I do wonder how that could translate into the what we actually see from him in the cage.
Yeah, it's a great question. And Aljamain Sterling has been very upfront and vocal and honest about that. He's talked about it in almost every interview that I've seen with him, but seems to have that fighter's Achilles heel, or at least the fighter's mindset that I think works against them at times, where he is basically like, I will show these motherfuckers. Like, I will do this thing that I know is bad, that I don't want to do, this thing that is bad potentially for my career, but I will show these motherfuckers when I win. It seems like it's an attitude that helps fighters make decisions that could be poor for their careers frequently. And, you know, not that they always have a choice, because here you got the UFC pressuring them frequently into doing things that they don't necessarily want to do. Aljamain Sterling right now about a 2-1 favorite. Sean O'Malley's about a 2-1 underdog. But I don't know, man. I look at this fight and honestly, I kind of think Sean O'Malley is a pretty live dog here. Like, physically, just in terms of a matchup of styles, I guess, you'd think Aljamain Sterling should win this. Like, he should be able to control Sean O'Malley, to kind of take away O'Malley's mobility and his stand-up game and keep this thing grounded and basically do what Aljamain Sterling does. But O'Malley's got so much length and he's so athletic and he seems to hit and kick so hard and he's kind of got the unorthodox techniques that he can break out that, like, I don't have a hard time imagining in my mind brain at all that Sean O'Malley lands something hard, a kick or a punch, and is able to finish this fight. Like, I don't know if I would bet that way, but I can see it. I can see it in my imagination. It's not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, the thing is, I guess, that if you ask yourself the question, can Sean O'Malley deal with the wrestling and grappling game of an Aljamain Sterling, who is not only just like a good wrestler and opportunistic submissions artist, but is, especially as his career has progressed, the man is very crafty. He's very clever and doesn't need much of an opening at all. And then the next thing you know, he's on your back and he's going to be there for a while. And he can take over that way. And you wonder, does Sean O'Malley have that in his game to deal with that? And I'm not saying he doesn't, but I am saying, I don't know if we've ever seen it really tested. Right. You know, that's the part I wonder about. I just don't know if the evidence is really there to suggest that he can deal with that if you run into full power Aljo. Because honestly, there's some things about some of the stuff that Aljamain Sterling has been saying in the lead of this fight that might concern me a little bit. Not only the stuff where he's talking about how he didn't really want to do this date and his body wasn't really feeling up to it and that he's kind of forced himself back in the training camp, but also saying that this, if he wins this, this is going to be his last one at 135, that he's going up a weight class. That kind of seems to me like a guy who maybe physically is dealing with some stuff that makes him think, like, I'm not going to be able to do this weight cut again. I got one more in me. And I don't know. Those are all some tough ways to go into a title defense when it's going to be your third title defense in less than a year. And we've seen guys kind of get worn down that way.
Yeah. To your point, Sean O'Malley has never gone five rounds. He's only been to decision in his UFC career three times. And they are all in three-round fights. So it would be interesting to see what would happen if Aljamain Sterling can drag him into that deep water of the fourth and fifth round. O'Malley seems like a guy who is probably in pretty good shape. But, you know, you get into a grueling wrestle or clinch battle, and it's going to take it out of you over a 25-minute fight. But I do think you're right about Aljamain Sterling. And I think if he is physically banged up, if he is mentally not 100% committed, if he anticipates a tough weight cut, any and or all of that, frankly, might give Sean O'Malley a great chance. I know this is one that it seems like on paper Aljamain Sterling should win, But I guess I keep talking about it. I just got a bad feeling about this for him. The vibes is off.
Ben. Oh, no. Here we go with the vibes.
The vibes may be off.
What's the percentage, the win percentage of guys with the when they, according to Chad Dundas, the vibes is off? Because I feel like they still win 60 to 70% of the time when the vibes is off.
Hey, if the vibes have a 30% win rate, that's better than most gamblers. So let's take it. Let's take that the vibes are off. All right. Let's do Are You Fucking Kidding Me? And then we will move on to round number two. Ben, did you see the UFC subtly try to erase Francis Ngannou?
Subtly,
from history over the weekend, putting up this graphic on the screen that says that Tafon Njukwi nailed it. Can you say the last name?
Njukwi.
They put a graphic up on the screen that says only Cameroonian fighter in UFC history, to completely ignore the fact that not only is the former heavyweight champion of the world, Francis Ngannou, from that country, not too long ago. He was a champ not too long ago. It's not like you could have forgot about that. He's the champ not too long ago. But also, as Francis Ngannou, man, every time this happens, Francis Ngannou is going to come up with the classiest possible response on social media. He is the one who points out himself that Thierry Sokaju was also Cameroonian and fought in the UFC. So Francis Ngannou isn't even out here claiming to be first. He's saying, I was second, and don't let them erase all of that from history. That just, like, that can't be a mistake, right? That can't be like a, whoops, we fucked up, our bad, forgot about Francis Ngannou and Sokaju, both of who previously fought in this organization. Right?
Yeah.
Can't be a mistake.
Nope.
You fucking kidding me?
That's not an oversight.
Are you fucking kidding me? You didn't just forget about Francis Ngannou.
No. You went out of your way.
Yeah. You went out of your way to forget about the guy. You fucking kidding me?
Fucking kidding me? Well, Chad, this week, my Are You Fucking Kidding Me? I'm scrolling around the social medias earlier, and I see a quote from Ian Machado Gary, who is on the undercard of UFC 292. Quote, I believe that I am carrying this 292 card on my back, and that if it wasn't for me, this card would go down the drain. Now, he said that on the MMA Fortnite. I can't be alone in thinking that there were a lot of people who found out he's on this card when they saw this quote. Which,
I mean, I found out he was on this card like 24 hours before I saw the quote, but still.
I've seen a lot of people talking about this fight card, all this stuff. I don't know if there's really any basis to think that Ian Gary's the one out here carrying it, though.
Yeah.
Especially because you got two title fights on this thing. And you got a challenger in one of those title fights who, as we just spent a lot of time talking about, has really connected strongly with the fan base. And then you got somebody else who people might be potentially excited about for the future, but a lot of people probably didn't even realize he was on this one until now. Are you fucking kidding me? I mean, I guess if you're just going to go out there, we're just going to say some stuff to try to get some attention, there are worse things you could do than to be like, I am the only thing people care about. And people go, wait, you're on this too? You're coming too? Okay. And now they know. Even if the way you got them to look over in your direction is by saying some outlandish shit. But are you fucking kidding me? If you're feeling the burden of carrying this one on your back, I'd say maybe don't worry about it too much. I think some of these other guys are helping you out more than you realize. Fucking kidding me.
Fucking kidding me. All right, that's going to do it for round number one. We'll be right back with round number two.
Well, Chad, Zhang Weili looked pretty, pretty, pretty good when she went out there and reclaimed the UFC Women's Strawweight Championship by beating Carla Esparza. Since those two back-to-back losses to Rose Namajunas, the first via a pretty well-set-up head kick by Rose, the second one via split decision, She has won two straight fights, had that knockout, that spitting back fist knockout that basically ended Joanna Jędrzejczyk's career. And then she went out there and dominated Carla Esparza. Now she turns right around, gonna defend the title again, and it's Amanda Lemos who's riding a two-fight win streak, which is not exactly a mandate that she certainly must fight for the title, beat Michelle Waterson and Marina Rodriguez, but it does kind of feel like we're back to Zhang Weili dominating this division, and we're kind of looking around and going, okay, who's next that we haven't seen yet? And it's Amanda Lemos. Basically, it seemed that maybe because we had this date in mind for a women's strawweight title fight, and she's the one who could say yes, so we're going to go ahead and do it real quick. For one thing, I want to ask, do you see anything that Amanda Lemos does that would give you any cause for concern for Zhang Weili, except for the possibility that the vibes could be off? Mm-hmm. Also, did the UFC miss an opportunity here by being like, we know Zhang Weili, the fighter that could really get all of China excited about her dominance in the UFC, let's put it in Boston.
Well, I thought they had it kind of set up that it was going to be Yan Xiaonan was going to be up next.
It looked that way.
Because if you're going to give a fighter with a two-fight win streak a title shot, it might have been Xiaonan, because she beat Mackenzie Dern and Jessica Andrade pretty recently. But, you know, the Andrade fight was only in May. She won a performance of the night bonus for that, if you're keeping score. Maybe she didn't think she could turn around that fast.
Oh, really? It was in May, the same month that Aljamain Sterling fought five fucking rounds against Henry Cejudo? No, we couldn't ask her to turn around and fight again in August. That's crazy talk.
Because it was just like slightly less than a year and a half ago that Amanda Lemos lost to Jessica Andrade. And so, I don't know, it seems like a kind of an offbeat choice. And it reminds me, you know, I use this comparison all the time of when Strikeforce was doing the heavyweight Grand Prix and they were like, oh, we will match Fedor and Alistair Overeem up in the second round. And then neither guy showed up for the second round. Spoiler alert, if you're just watching that Strikeforce Heavyweight Grand Prix. If you got a fight you want to make, make it. Make it before you lose it. Because you're playing with fire when you don't make it. Now, specifically to your point about Amanda Lemos and the vibes, the vibes may not be off for this one. But Amanda Lemos hits pretty hard. So there's that. You asked me if there's anything that worries me. It's probably that. It's that she hits pretty hard. She's finished all but two of her fights in the UFC. By either TKO or submission. The fact that she has lost twice, once to Leslie Smith by TKO, and of course the arm triangle choke submission to Jessica Andrade, does not make me feel that confident. But she could mess around and land a punch, and, you know, here we are again. I should note that the odds in this one, pretty similar for Amanda Lemos as Sean O'Malley. She is plus 250, so a little bit longer of a dog than Sean O'Malley. Zhang Weili is minus 310. So the odds makers seem relatively confident in Zhang Weili's abilities here.
Yeah, and I think with good reason. Like, if you were going to ask me to pick an underdog here that I could talk myself into believing might win, I picked Sean O'Malley way before I picked Amanda Lemos. Because I think this, like, Zhang Weili is just really, really fucking good, man. And she doesn't have a lot of holes in the game. It's hard for me to see what you're really looking to capitalize on there. Especially, she can be really aggressive at times, but not in a reckless way. She's fast, but she's also powerful. She strikes with good power. She can wrestle. You're not going to bully her around the cage. But she can also, she gets you down there, she makes smart choices, gets good positions, looks to throw strikes, and then if you open it up for a submission, she'll take it. I just, it's hard for me to see, other than, you know, you land one good shot, and that could always happen, but
yeah,
I don't know, man. It's hard for me to see her lose in this one.
I kind of agree, but I guess that's why they have the fights, right, Ben?
That, and to make a whole bunch of fucking money, is why they have the fights.
Your advice to either one of these two would be, make it obvious that you won.
Yeah, what you're going to want to do is not rely on the judges' subtle appreciation of the fighting arts. The fighting arts. You want to go in there and be like, make it really clear that you won.
Ben, Chris Weidman back. Is back. He returns for a fight against Brad Tavares, his first appearance in the UFC since his own leg injury against Uriah Hall in April of 2021. His own horrific leg injury, which I don't know how, that's like being struck by lightning, right? To have that happen to your leg after it already done happened to Anderson Silva while you were out there in the cage with him. You know the UFC is going to call Brad Tavares in a situation like this, right? This Brad Tavares seems to be the guy. He's like, we need Chris Weidman to fight someone kind of tough, but also someone we think he has a chance to beat. Let's call Brad Tavares. And so here comes Chris Weidman, the former middleweight champion, his first fight in a couple years against Brad Tavares. Well, are you happy to see Chris Weidman back?
You know, I get it. I get why he feels like he can't end on that, that you got to come back because you don't want it to be the thing where people look at you and be like, oh yeah, he was having a career. It was kind of on a downward line. Then he broke his damn leg and was never heard from again. You want to kind of show people like, okay, that didn't stop me. I can come back from that. And we have seen people come back from it. If you get the right care and everything, and you know, you can come back and continue to fight. The broken leg part doesn't worry me as much as just where things seem to be headed for Chris Weidman before the broken leg. Like, you know, it didn't seem like we were on a great path beforehand. And so I like Chris Weidman, want to see kind of good things happen for Chris Weidman. And yet he's sort of getting into that territory where when he shows up on a fight card now, there's a part of me that goes, I hope this one isn't going to make me sad. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. I guess I agree with that. He's 39 years old, so probably nearing the end of the road regardless of his various health issues. And so I do understand why Chris Weidman would return, but I also agree. I hope it doesn't make us sad. Maybe Brad Tavares is the guy they call when they're like, we need Chris Weidman to fight somebody, but in a fight that is less likely to make everyone sad. Call Brad Tavares. If I was Ian Gary, I don't know if I'd be talking this shit before I got to go out there and fight Neil Magny. You know what I mean? Like,
Neil Magny has done played spoiler on some people before.
Yes, he has. Yes, he has. And it seems like Ian Gary may be just tempting the MMA gods a little bit with his talk leading up to this.
Yeah. I mean, Neil Magny is one of those guys where not too many people ever had an easy night against Neil Magny, you know?
No, a lot of ways. He's going to try to make it ugly and
clock in. Yeah.
He's going to make you clock in. That's a good way to put it. And I guess finally down, well, Blackshear went out there and like he had a twister, right? He's the guy that got the twister last week. And here he is jumping in for Cody Garbs the week of the event. He's going to go out there and fight Mario Bautista. So that's kind of interesting. We'll look forward to that one. And then, of course, down at the bottom, you got Chito Vera coming in off his loss to Corey Sandhagen in March. He is going to fight Pedro Munhoz, who's just one fight removed now from the Sean O'Malley fight that ended in the accidental eye poke that I apparently had wiped from my memory banks. But he did go out there and beat Chris Gutierrez in April of this year. So that's, you know, that'll probably be fun. That seems like a fun little pay-per-view opener here.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
It seems like we've been rolling out a lot of pay-per-views right in a row. It doesn't seem like we've had much of a break between those, and that kind of makes me wonder, how are we going to do here in terms of fan interest? I guess for the UFC, they have this cushion of the ESPN guaranteed licensing fee, but this just seems like one, if I had been shelling out $80 over and over again for these UFC pay-per-views, unless I was one of the youngs who's really interested in Sean O'Malley, I might give this one a pass, I got to say. Might keep my money in my pocket.
Yeah. I mean, the way I think to do it, if you have to make a tough case for people to keep buying your pay-per-views after you stack one on top of another, is if you have a good card sort of in the aggregate, I think you have a better chance there. If you have just like one or two fights that people care about, they'll go, I might be able to find those via other means. But if you can sell them on the idea of we have, you know, a good main card 2 to 3 hours of good, solid fighting content and you want to just be able to relax and not to worry about your stream buffering or falling out, then it's worth paying for it. I don't know if you quite get there with this one, but you're kind of close.
That's going to do it for round number two. We'll look back on Vicente Luque and Rafael Dos Anjos coming up in round three. That starts right now. Well, Ben, Vicente Luque pulled a bit of a fast one on us this past weekend. He goes out there against Rafael Dos Anjos in their main event fight on this UFC Fight Night event from down there at the Apex, and he looks far more reserved than we're used to seeing from him, far more measured, I guess you could say, less wild, a little bit less aggressive, a little bit less willing to take those risks, and plus relying on the grappling a little bit here, which is not necessarily what you think of when you talk about the silent assassin, although he has been pretty good in that area. Seemed maybe to take Rafael Dos Anjos a little bit by surprise as well. But these two guys have a grueling and dirty and sweaty 25-minute fight. I don't know that it was that awesome to watch, but Vicente Luque does indeed emerge with the unanimous decision win over RDA. Close fight, but I think the judges probably got it right here. But then Vicente Luque jumps on the mic. As we all know, he had a brain hemorrhage last year in the wake of a knockout loss to Jeff Neal. Starts talking about how it was a miracle for him to be out there. God had cured him, allowed him to get cleared for the fight. He was a little bit scared to get hit at the beginning of the fight, but everything worked out. He got the victory. I know it's a lot to unpack. I don't totally know where to start with it, but what do you think here? Vicente Luque, walking miracle?
Well, I mean, I found it really interesting. We talked about it a little bit beforehand where he was saying that he, when asked, you know, if he felt especially bad or like something bad was happening when he had that brain injury, and he was like, well, honestly, I don't know. I've never been knocked out before, so I felt like this. I guess this is what it's like when you're knocked out, and it didn't feel good, but I wasn't able to be like, that's definitely a brain injury. I have a really serious problem here. And so I could understand that. It got to be kind of scary coming back from that. You know, I'm sure a whole lot of stuff could be going through your mind. And if you told me that a guy coming back from that was like, you know, what my game plan is going to be for this one is wrestle and clinch against the fence heavy. Yeah. Like, I would understand that. I would absolutely understand. I also think, though, that like it was not a bad way to go about it against Rafael Dos Anjos, who has been able to do that himself to a lot of lightweights, but going up in weight, I don't think he's able to do it as easily. And yeah. I think that like there were a couple moments in this fight, especially early on, as they're both battling for position in the clinch and up against the fence, where it kind of seemed like this. Usually if Rafael Dos Anjos can get there, he can kind of smother you, and he has no problem overpowering guys from that range and in there, and he wasn't able to do it against Luque. Luque was turning him against that fence and then going after him, and he seemed like a little bit flustered by that and like he didn't quite have an answer.
One of the interesting things I thought is that in the post-fight interview for this, I think it was Daniel Cormier doing the interview in the cage after it was over, basically said even the officials here in Nevada said, if it looks like Vicente Luque gets in any trouble, we're going to stop this thing. Which, first of all, I'm like, I guess I'm glad that oversight exists. I guess I'm glad that they were paying attention to it, that someone was watching it. But also, that's different than we're totally not worried. Right?
Yes,
like that's not a like we are 100% sure everything is fine here situation. So sometimes I feel like in those, you know, the moment of those post-fight interviews where it's unscripted, you don't totally know what's going to happen, we end up finding some stuff out. And I think this was one of those cases.
Yeah. I would think like that's troubling because it says you were establishing a different standard for this guy based on what you knew of his recent medical condition, but also you were required to stand there and say the recent medical condition is not a concern. He can fight. And so it's like, which one is it? Because those two things don't really go together, man. Like, if especially if I were Vicente Luque and I heard that afterwards, I would be like, wait a minute, what? Like, they told me I was fine. They told me I was good to go.
I was cured by God.
Yeah. You hear that and you're like, wait a minute. You guys sitting there with your finger on the button? You're that concerned about my brain? But everybody told me I could go ahead and get in this cage fight and get punched in the head and I was under no more risk than anybody else? I don't know about that.
Here is an interesting side note from this fight, and we did get this email from John Lee about it. He writes, I was buzzed and came home from the pool for that terrible main event, and it struck me when Anthony Smith texted into the broadcast to say that Vicente Luque was using RDA's ankle wraps to get takedowns. Did he lose the fight because of the wraps? He gave away two rounds and momentum when that happened. Weirdest sport ever, he says. This was an interesting aspect of this fight that Rafael Dos Anjos came out at the beginning with the double ankle wraps on. And Ben, you know what Boss Rutten says. Mm-hmm. If you've got one bum ankle and you're going to wear an ankle wrap, you better wear two so that your opponent doesn't know which one of your ankles is not at 100%. Boss might even say, wear the ankle wrap on the other ankle just to try to trick the other guy into thinking that the healthy one is the one that's hurt. But Vicente Luque was kind of doing unorthodox kind of ankle pick takedowns when he got up against the fence, and he was apparently, I didn't notice it at the time, but grabbing onto RDA's ankle wraps and taking him down. And then in between rounds, Rafael Dos Anjos' corner knew that that was happening, so they took the ankle wraps off so that RDA didn't have to worry about that anymore, so that Vicente Luque wouldn't have that advantage. And that is an interesting wrinkle here. And that, as I think it was Paul Felder on the broadcast said, that's good corner work to see that that was happening and to take the ankle wraps off.
Yeah, he wasted no time getting this off too. When he saw, okay, he came back and he was just like, give me these. Like, yeah. Just yanked them right off there. But by then, you know, you could argue that some of the damage had been done there. I mean, it makes me wonder, do you think they just didn't consider that possibility? Because did they think, well, if anybody's going to be doing any wrestling and reaching for ankles here, it's going to be us.
Yeah, I do think that. I think that they expected a far more stand-up oriented fight from Vicente Luque. And I don't think that they expected so much clinch. I don't think they expected so many takedowns. And despite the fact that, as noted on the broadcast, the Darce choke kind of a thing is kind of Vicente Luque's move. I don't think they really expect. I think that they expected kind of what we all expected, to have a more stand-up oriented kind of a slugfest here, and it just didn't materialize.
Okay, so new strategy. If you got a guy, one of those dudes where he's got great jujitsu, especially off his back and stuff, but he ain't got no wrestling, not really much for the boxing either, and you're like, we want to get to the ground game, but we don't know how to get it there. Show up in some ankle wraps, maybe some knee sleeves, a lot for your opponent to grab onto and think he's really being smart by using it to take you down. And then, Jed, you got him right where you want him.
Yeah, no, the BJJ guys should think about that, frankly. All right, let's do just saying stuff, and then we will get out of here for this week. Ben, what is your just saying stuff?
Well, Chad, I'm going to read to you a headline. It comes from Damon Martin's story over on MMAfighting.com, and it reads thusly, Conor McGregor claims he's fighting Michael Chandler in December, comma, calls out KSI and bare knuckle.
Yeah. Yeah, he actually, I think he laid out a three-fight plan for himself, right? He wants Chandler in December, then he wants Justin Gaethje, then he wants, for the prestigious BMF belt, I should say, he wants Justin Gaethje. And then he wants to complete the trilogy with Nate Diaz, and then just to spice things up, just to sprinkle, he did a little sprinkle on top of all that to say he would fight KSI in a bare-knuckle boxing match.
I'm just saying, Chad, I appreciate that we put these two things next to each other in the headline because then it sort of lessens the danger that we might just take for granted what he says is the truth. Right. Because
that we might take it seriously at all, right?
Right. Because if you first say, I'm going to fight Michael Chandler in December, we go, okay, that does sound like that was probably the original plan and what you should have been planning to do all along, even though here it is mid-August, and as far as we know, you're not even back in the USADA testing pool, and there seems to be no hurry. and getting you there, which should raise some questions just to begin with. But if you say you're fighting Michael Chandler in December, that does sound like something completely plausible. But if you go from that to, and then these other fights, and then I'm going to do a bare-knuckle boxing match with this fucking influencer guy. Thank you for adding all that, just so we go, okay, wait a minute. I was about to believe the first one, you know? It's like, yeah. Chad, if you asked me like what I'm doing Friday night and I was like, oh, I thought I might walk up to the town and country, have a couple beers. And you go, well, yeah, that does sound like what Ben would be doing on a Friday night. I don't have a hard time believing that. And then I was like, and then I'm going to get in my race car and I'm going to drive down the street so fast that it takes off into the sky and starts flying like a jet into the stratosphere. And you go, well, okay, now I don't know if he's even planning on doing the first thing.
Yeah.
I'm just saying I appreciate Conor McGregor doing it this way so that we are not in danger of taking any of it too seriously.
Conor McGregor is playing two truths and a lie.
I mean, it's ambitious to think there's two truths in there.
It'd take 15 years for Conor McGregor to have that many fights. I should just point out during Just Saying Stuff, Conor McGregor also hashtag Just Saying Stuff.
Just saying stuff.
Well, Ben, remember a couple weeks ago, was a big kerfuffle there in the MMA space about the UFC not giving Stephen Thompson his money after it was Michel Pereira that came out and missed weight, and then Stephen Thompson didn't want to fight him, and then he didn't get his money, and we all had a big stink over it, and then Dana White came out and said, hold on, you motherfuckers, we're not just going to give this fucking guy $250,000 for doing nothing, et cetera, et cetera.
I do recall that kerfuffle.
Stephen Thompson was on the MMA Hour with Ariel Helwani this week, and I'm looking at the transcription on the MMA Fighting Newswire. Here is what he says. He says a lot of other stuff. He says he learned from fighting Darren Till, who had missed weight and then came in, and he had some trouble with him in their fight. Here's the quote now. When you sign that contract, you're giving me your word, a man's word, which nowadays it doesn't mean a whole lot to some people, but it does to me. It's your word that you're going to do what's on the contract, and it's going to that you're going to be able to make this fight happen and make that weight. It's one thing. Just make the weight. And then he goes on to say, I want everybody to know right now in the 170-pound division that if you're going to fight me now, you better make weight or it's not going to happen. I'm at a place in my career where I want to fight. I want to fight fairly. I don't want to play any games. So this week, I'm just saying, if the UFC was trying to teach Stephen Thompson a lesson by not giving him his money, it doesn't sound like it took. It sounds like Stephen Thompson is unrepentant that he is out here saying, hey, dudes, make weight or it ain't happening. And frankly, more power to him as far as I'm concerned. I'm just saying.
Just saying.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event Podcast. Don't forget, we're over on the Patreon page all week long. We got Wednesdays live chat, Thursdays doing the damn thing podcast, and Fridays Power Hour, where we will probably be zooming in a little closer and taking another look, I would think, at UFC 292. Get you guys primed for the weekend. You know how to do it. Come join the party. Comainevent.com to email the podcast, or patreon.com/comainevent if you want to come check all that content out that I just mentioned. We'll talk to you next week if you are a free listener, and the Patreons will see you on tomorrow, I guess Tuesday, we recorded this thing. That's weird. Fucks up my whole week.
Fucks up your understanding of the days themselves.
Fuck, yeah. As for right now, thanks for listening, everybody. We are done. We are through. We are out. I guess in this case, it actually makes me feel better because here I am thinking it's Monday and it's actually Tuesday. You know what I mean? It's like I got a free day.
You didn't, though.
No, I had to live both days by wretched existence. To live out both days, both each seeming to take 100 years.
Waking up yet again, looking to the sky and muttering, what fresh hell is this?
There you go. And then we'll do it again tomorrow with the live chat.